My voice shook a little. Consider yourself served, son. He handed me a sealed envelope, then held out his clipboard. Sign here, and that lets the judge know you received this subpoena to appear in court.
Court?
Don't tell me Sheriff Smith never said nothing to you about the trial they're fixing to have up in Sumner. You know about that colored boy that got himself kidnapped and killed?
He asked me to stay in Greenwood, but he didn't say anything about a trial.
The deputy handed me a pencil and tapped the clipboard. Not my problem, son. Signing this only means I handed you the subpoena. Whether or not you end up testifying in court is up to the judge and the lawyers. And I suppose maybe because you're a juvenile, you won't even have to testify if you don't want to. But I'm just delivering this.
He paused, looking at the clipboard. And if you'll sign it, I can get back to work.
I signed the form and he left. Grandpa was awake when I came back into the house.
Naomi again?
No, sir. It was a deputy. He brought me this. I handed the envelope to Grandpa. He opened it and read the subpoena. When he finished, he didn't say anything for a while. Finally, he said,
I don't like this, son, not one bit. It's one thing for you to talk to George Smith about what R.C.'s done and said, but testifying in court, you're just a boy, and this business is too dirty for you to be getting mixed up in.
Do I have a choice?
Of course you have a choice. Last I checked, we're still living in the United States of America, regardless of what the NAACP and those outside agitators say. If I was you, Hiram, I'd keep my mouth shut about this whole thing. It's going to be ugly, maybe even dangerous. Northern rabble-rousers will be there, and some of our local rednecks aren't going to take too kindly to that. And didn't you say that R.C. had threatened you?
Not exactly threatened, but I sure felt warned. He doesn't want me talking to Sheriff Smith about what he did to Emmett while we were fishing.
That boy's dangerous. You ought to lay low, keep quiet, and let things work themselves out. No need for you to risk getting hurt. The judge can make you appear in court, but you don't have to tell everything you know, especially when testifying might put you in serious danger.
I nodded. R.C. scared me, for sure, but shouldn't I tell all the truth? Even if I was afraid?
Now what about this R.C. Rydell?
Grandpa asked.
You want me to talk to the sheriff about his threatening you? You got a right to feel safe here, anywhere, and the law's bound to protect you. If you're worried that he's going to come after you, I can ask the sheriff to have him locked up if they find him. Or maybe have a deputy keep an eye on the house while you're here. You know that boy, Hiram. You know he can be real trouble.
I guess I wouldn't mind if a deputy kind of hung around here for a while, just in case. I hoped I'd never see R.C. again, because if he really wanted to get me, having a deputy around wasn't going to stop him.
If you talk in court, Hiram, you're going to stir up R.C. pretty good. There's no way you can keep it secret. Trials are public, and whatever gets said is going to show up in the Commonwealth. So even if old R.C. has enough sense to steer clear of the Sumner courthouse, he's going to hear that you spoke against him in court.
Thinking about R.C. made me shiver. I know I'd be crazy to tell everything at that trial. R.C. scares me to death. If I had my choice, I'd be on a train tonight headed back to Tempe. But Emmett Till is dead, Grandpa, for no good reason. He had as much right to be here in LaFleur County as I do. He was just a kid like me.
Hold on, son. He was a colored boy who didn't know his place.
That doesn't give R.C. and those two other men the right to murder him.
Grandpa's face turned serious.
You don't know for sure who did the killing, Hiram. You've got to remember that Chicago boy made his own trouble. If he'd stayed in his place, he'd be alive today, and believe me, son, I truly wish none of this had happened.
Grandpa looked exhausted.
Not a single bit of it.
But it did happen, and that boy is dead, and we both know that R.C. Rydell had something to do with it. Sure, he scares me, but don't I owe Emmett something? Isn't it my duty to do something about it?
You don't owe that boy a damn thing. For starters, he's dead. All the talking in the world isn't going to change that, and you're in the Delta, son. No jury down here would even dream of punishing white boys for putting a Negro in his place. Sure, they got carried away something awful, but they're local men, white men. The only thing you'll do by speaking up in that trial is to get yourself hurt, maybe hurt bad.
Grandpa sounded so wrong-headed, I couldn't believe it. Maybe some of what Dad was always spouting about equality and the American dream had rubbed off on me. Don't American laws apply in the Delta? What R.C. and those two men did was wrong, Grandpa. It makes me sick just to think about it.
Because you're a decent young man. You come from good stock, Hiram.
If I'm so decent, shouldn't I tell what I know about R.C.? He killed a boy, Grandpa, and I could have stopped him.
Now, Hiram, you already did more than you had to. Calling the sheriff and everything. Not many boys your age would have had the courage to, but I should have done more. Maybe I could have stopped R.C. that night, made him stay here. Maybe if I had followed him.
Grandpa waved his hand impatiently.
You're forgetting that two grown men are already in jail for the crime, and they've admitted to kidnapping the boy. They would have done what they did whether or not R.C. was there, and you don't know for sure that he was there, Hiram.
But he told me he was going to Money with a couple of men, that they were going to teach a northern Negro a lesson. Emmett disappeared the next night.
Just because he planned to go up there doesn't mean he ever did. Look at what you're saying, son. You've already convicted R.C. for a crime you can't be sure he committed. How are you going to look in court? Are you willing to accuse a boy everybody knows is a big talker of kidnapping and murder based on a conversation you had with him one night?
Grandpa, I know R.C. and what he can do. I've seen what he's done before.
So what? Do you have proof that he went to Mose Wright's house that night? That he was with Bryant and Millam? That he helped them kill that boy? You got any proof of that?
But he said,
don't matter what he said, Hiram. The court's interested in what he did, in what can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you really think that a jury made up of white Delta men is going to take your word over that of a local boy? Like I said, if you tell everything in that trial, the only thing you're going to do is get yourself hurt and embarrass me.
Embarrass you?
People around here have long memories, son. They remember how your daddy was. How I couldn't talk or whip any sense into him when he got to be your age. You have no idea how humiliating it is when a boy shames his family. Friends and neighbors said they understood, that they felt sorry about how Harlan and I battled. But I know that behind my back they talked about how I was a poor father, that if I had raised Harlan right, he wouldn't have shamed me. His voice trailed off. Your daddy. You can't be like your daddy.
Grandpa sat quietly until Ruth Ann called us to supper. He looked up a little confused, like he'd been dreaming or something, and waved me over to help him out of his chair.
You get in court and talk against white folks, Hiram, and people around here will see your daddy in you. Contrary, that's what he was. Didn't like the South, the Southern ways. The Delta wasn't good enough for him.
He wiped his mouth and his hand trembled.
I don't think I could take it again. That public condemnation, friends gossiping, feeling shame because of what my boy did and said. I raised you different, Hiram. You are not like your father. You're a good Delta boy through and through.
Grandpa patted my arm.
You're a good boy, son, and I've been proud of you. I know you'll do the right thing.
Neither one of us said much during supper. Grandpa seemed worn out, tired, and like his mind was on something else, and I just didn't feel like talking. Ruth Ann had made one of my favorite dinners, but it didn't taste very good that night. Thinking about R.C., Emmett, Dad, and Grandpa, and the trial pretty much ruined me for eating. I managed a drumstick and a couple scoops of mashed potatoes and coleslaw, and then excused myself. I needed to get out of the house. I needed to see Naomi. Grandpa said nothing when I left the table and headed for the kitchen.
You feeling all right, Mr. Hiram? Asked Ruth Ann when I came in. Not like you to leave my fried chicken and fixings uneaten like that.
I shrugged. Just been worrying about this trial.
You let the judge and lawyers worry about that. And I bet they're plenty worried themselves. I never thought I'd see it happen. But they got two white men sitting in jail right now, and they're going to send them to trial. Far as I know, this is the first time in the history of Mississippi that white men are going to be made to account for what they've done to a black man.
Ruth Ann's eyes filled with tears.
Nothing any jury can do to bring Emmett back. But they sure can let folks in the Delta know that things are changing. Changing at last.
I'm really sorry about Emmett, Ruth Ann. Awful sorry. I don't know why, but I felt like crying then. I blinked the tears back. I wished it had never happened. It should have never happened.
I appreciate that, Mr. Hiram, she said as she dabbed her eyes.
Ain't nothing you could have done about it, I know, but I do appreciate your sympathies.
But maybe I could have done something. Maybe I can now.
What's done is done. You couldn't have stopped old Milam and Bryan anyway. The law and the good Lord will take care of those two and anyone else mixed up in their wickedness.
Somehow I felt mixed up in their wickedness. Mixed up and not knowing how to get out of it.
Ruth Ann took a deep breath, ready to change the subject.
You heading outside?
Thought I'd take a walk. I need to get out of the house for a while.
She pointed to the kitchen garbage pail next to the back door. Why don't you take that with you to the garbage on your way out? And Mr. Hiram? Ruth Ann said, smiling. Don't you be too late talking with that Naomi girl. You know how her daddy gets.
I never said anything about Naomi. I just...
Don't I just me, Hiram Hilburn. I got boys of my own back home. Now get this trash and yourself out of the house before that poor girl starts worrying about what happened to you.
It felt good to be outside. A few stars had edged over the dark, tree-lined horizon. A light breeze stirred the humid night air, and the steady drone of frogs and crickets was the only sound as I emptied the trash into the garbage can behind the garage and walked along the driveway to the sidewalk in front of the house. As I walked through the shadows of the trees that lined the sidewalk, I felt like I was leaving the worries about R.C. and the trial behind. It didn't take long to get to the bridge, and I felt better than I had all day when I saw Naomi leaning over the bridge railing, looking down into the dark water of the Yazoo. Her hair swayed in the night breeze, hiding her face. She didn't move when I stood alongside her and leaned over the railing myself.
What are you looking at?
My arm rested next to Naomi's, barely touching.
The color of the river. During the day it looks so yellow-green. But soon as it's dark, you'd never know it ever had a speck of color in it. Where's all that color go, I wonder?
Without talking, we watched the dark currents of the Yazoo swirl under the bridge below us. Finally, Naomi turned and faced me.
Hey, Hiram.
Hey, Naomi.
You been here long?
A while.
Tonight wasn't a good night to be home.
Paws on a tear again. She turned around and leaned against the railing. No bruises, at least none I could see. That meant she had gotten out in time.
Drinking?
Always that.
But the last couple days... The sheriff's come by looking for R.C., and Pa don't know where he is.
Sheriff thinks Pa's lying and warned him that R.C.'s a fugitive, and if Pa's hiding him, he'll land himself in jail.
Soon as the sheriff leaves, Pa cusses him, R.C., the NAACP, President Eisenhower, and anybody else he's mad at. Then he starts up drinking again and slows down for a while, and that's when I know I got to get out of there.
What's the sheriff want R.C. for? I asked.
Says he just wants to ask him some questions about that Negro boy got killed up in Money.
He say why?
The way R.C. talks, I suppose. Everybody knows he hates Negroes and how he treats them.
He's been in trouble with the law plenty of times before, but this time it galls Pa something awful. He rants and raves. Never thought I'd live to see the day when a white lawman would bother a white citizen of the state of Mississippi about nigger trouble. R.C. ain't no saint, not by a long shot, but my boy's white, and the law got no business worrying him about some black boy floated up in the Tallahatchie. It makes him hateful, Hiram, worse than drinking.
You seen R.C. lately?
Not since Sunday. I don't know where he is, and I'm worried. I'm sure he knows the sheriff's after him. Ain't the first time he's disappeared for a while.
Do you think he had anything to do with that trouble and money?
R.C.'s done a lot of stupid things, but he's my brother, Hiram. I don't think he'd murder somebody.
She looked at me, a little unsure of herself. I guess they're planning on having a big trial up in Sumner, I said. Naomi nodded.
Sheriff wants me to be ready to testify. I got a subpoena today.
Testify for what? How could you know anything about that murder? You don't even know anybody in money.
I know R.C.
So what? Lots of people know R.C. Why do they want you?
I told her what R.C. had said the night before the kidnapping. Next day, Emmett Till was missing, and so was R.C. Naomi's face turned sad.
You think R.C. was with those men?
I don't know. That day R.C. and I went fishing, we met Emmett Till and some of his friends at the river. R.C. did something terrible to him.
Did he hurt him?
No, but he scared and shamed him. I don't know, Naomi. If you'd seen how R.C. acted at the river, how cold-blooded he was. Then after he told me he was going to money.
You can't talk about this in court, Hiram.
Naomi's eyes opened wide.
You can't say another thing about this.
I know he's your brother, and it'll be bad for him, if anything.
Blast my brother, it'll be bad for you.
Do you think R.C. or any of his Peckerwood friends will let you get away with speaking against white men for doing something to a Negro? And even if you get back to Arizona, do you know what they'll do to your grandpa? You can't talk in court, Hiram, you just can't. If anything happened to you, if R.C. did something to you...
Her voice shook.
I just couldn't stand it. She grabbed my hand and squeezed it hard.
You stay away from that trial, Hiram Milburn. I don't care if you have to sneak out of town and I never see you again, but you stay away from that trial. You just stay away, hear me?
Then she leaned into me and started to cry. I held her while she buried her face against my chest, and I wanted to stay with her like that for as long as I could. Holding her made me forget about everything else that had gone wrong that Mississippi summer. Right then, the only thing I wanted to remember about my weeks in Greenwood was standing alone with Naomi Rydell on the Yazoo Bridge, thinking not about Emmett or R.C. or Grandpa or Dad, but about Naomi and how I wanted to protect her.
Chapter 13. Naomi wouldn't let me walk her home that night. Who knows what kind of mood Pa'll be in? And besides, R.C. might be around. I sure didn't want to run into R.C., but I didn't want Naomi walking home alone either.
I can get home fine by myself, Hiram, she insisted. Been doing it for years and haven't had a problem yet.
Before we said goodbye, she took my hand in both of hers and stared at me, her eyes glistening in the dark.
You remember what I told you about that trial? It won't do nobody no good if you get up and talk. So decide right now you'll have nothing to do with it.
She squeezed my hand.
Promise, Hiram. Promise you won't go to the trial, won't say anything about R.C. or anything else.
Maybe they won't even ask me to testify. Maybe I'll go and just sit around at the trial and the lawyers will decide they don't want to hear from me.
There hasn't been anything in the Commonwealth about the third man for a while, so maybe they've given up looking for R.C. Or maybe the district attorney decided just to go after Bryant and Millam because they've already confessed to kidnapping. And maybe you're wrong. Don't do it, Hiram. Don't be stupid. Time passed as slow as mud. Mom called every 3 or 4 days to see how I was doing. We never talked long, and we never talked about Dad. Except once. Your father and I want you to know that we're very concerned about your safety, Hiram. Are you sure things are going to stay under control? Mom, it's going to be all right. I don't even know for sure if I'll end up talking in the trial anyway. Still, we'd feel better if... She paused. Hiram, your father wants to speak to you. Dad wanted to talk to me? I couldn't believe it. Hiram? Hey, Dad. He cleared his throat. Son, I want you to know that your mother or I will be out there immediately if you need us. We've even checked into one of us flying there if we have to. We're worried about this trial mess you've gotten into. It's going to be okay. Grandpa told me. Your grandfather! He said quickly and too loud. I heard him take a breath. Your grandfather is not in any situation to make promises like that. Besides, I am your father, Hiram, and I'm the one who must ultimately be responsible for your safety. It felt good to hear Dad say that. Very good. Thanks, Dad. But I've even talked to the sheriff. George Smith? Yes, sir. George is all right. What did he tell you? That there's no way out of the subpoena. I can't leave Greenwood, but he's got someone watching the house, and he promised he'd keep an eye out for anyone who might be looking for trouble. I believe him, Dad, and I'm not scared, honest. That was a lie. Well, you listen to me. Sheriff Smith is a good man, but you're still in the heart of the Delta, son, and some people down there get crazy about anything they think's going to threaten their Jim Crow ways. Things can get dangerous fast. You're a smart boy. I expect you to use your head. I will. I promise. Good. And remember, you need me or your mother. You call us immediately. It'll take some arranging. Mom's got all the kids, and I've got school just starting up. But if you need us, one of us will be out there just as fast as we can. Grandpa's taking good care of things. I'll be fine, Dad. Well, if you're sure, Hiram. But you remember what I said. I thanked Dad and said goodbye. Nothing he said changed a thing about what was going on in Greenwood. But almost everything he said made me feel better about him. About us. While I waited for the trial, school had started in Greenwood. And during the day when all the kids in town, including Naomi, were in class, I did what I could to keep from going stir-crazy. Some mornings I'd stay home and read library books or take Grandpa's truck and go for a drive in the country. Other times Grandpa and I went out to check his fields. A couple mornings a week we went fishing, but always on the Yazoo instead of the Tallahatchie. It was strange because Grandpa never used to fish the Yazoo. But when I asked him about it, he just shrugged it off. Most afternoons, Grandpa dropped in on his friends in the courthouse. Like Grandpa, they'd all taken a sharp interest in the trial and agreed that they needed to make sure that the NAACP and the outside agitators from the North didn't keep the Mississippi court from doing its job. Most of them worried that the school integration law had started things going in a bad way and that Northern rabble-rousers would use the trial to force other changes in the South. We've kept the races separated for a long time, and we don't intend to change now, was what Grandpa or one of his friends usually ended up saying. The Commonwealth said Sheriff Smith had lots of threatening letters and phone calls from people in Chicago and Mississippi. Somebody even said a caravan of 1,000 Negroes was on its way down from Chicago to go after Millam and Bryant. And that worried the sheriff enough that he called in the National Guard to protect the county jail.
On Tuesday, the same day they had a huge funeral for Emmett up in Chicago, the big news around Greenwood, news that surprised most everybody, including Grandpa, was that the grand jury had indicted Milam and Bryant for murder and kidnapping. Even though they'd already admitted to kidnapping Emmett Till, they pleaded innocent to both charges. Because the trial was going to be held up in Tallahatchie County, and probably because Sheriff Smith was worrying about keeping the peace, on Wednesday, Bryan and Milam got moved to the Tallahatchie County Jail up in Charleston. For a while, no one was sure how long they'd be there because no one knew when they'd have the trial. Some said it could be all the way in March 1956. But on Friday, the Commonwealth announced the trial would begin on September 19th. 9 days. Only 9 days to decide whether or not I'd tell the truth if I had to sit in the witness chair. Even if I hadn't been sweating what I'd say if I had to testify, I would have been thinking about the trial most of the time anyway. Almost every day the paper had something about the case, and even if you didn't read the paper, anywhere you went in the county, you'd hear people talking about it. This was the biggest thing ever to hit Greenwood, maybe ever to hit Mississippi. On a Monday afternoon, a week before the trial was supposed to start, Grandpa and I were at the courthouse and he was talking with a friend about their White Citizens Council. I could tell he didn't want me hanging around while they talked, and to be honest, I didn't want to be there either. So I walked down to the lobby to get a Coke from Mr. Paul. He opened the bottle and set it on the counter. "So, Hiram, you got your wish to stick around in Greenwood a little longer. You've been enjoying the extra summer vacation?" "You know, I used to think I'd love a longer summer vacation, but I'm kind of missing school." He smiled. "Sometimes when we get what we've always wanted, we realize it's not what we thought it was. When I was your age, I wanted more than anything to get away from Greenwood for a while and find out what the rest of the world was like. Then World War II came along and gave me my wish. I saw plenty of the world, until this, of course." He pointed to his eyes. "And the whole time I was gone, the only place I could think of was little old Greenwood, Mississippi. Life sure has a funny way of teaching us lessons, don't it?" "Yes, sir," I said. "But it seems like some people never learn any of those lessons, no matter how many times they're taught." "Oh, they learn them, Hiram. They just don't know it. Sometimes it takes a change of scenery or a good whack in the head to help you recognize the lessons you've learned." This change of scenery sure made me realize that Greenwood, well, it's different. Lots different from what I thought it was. "You're not the only person these days wondering about Mississippi. From what I hear, people up north, Negro and white, are pretty hot about that boy's death. For all the trouble this has caused, some folks down here are wishing that boy's body would have stayed at the bottom of the Tallahatchie. And that trial next week's going to heat things up more than anything." "Do you think the trial will change anything around here?" "You know anything about the South," Mr. Paul said. "You know we change slower than a tombstone. Oh, it might be a little step forward, but that Negro boy ain't the first to be murdered down here, and I'm afraid he won't be the last." "Mr. Paul, if you had a chance to be in the trial, you know, like a witness or something, what would you do?" "If I knew something that proved those two didn't kill that boy, I'd feel obliged to testify. And if I had something that would convict him, well, I'd have to plan on closing my shop and heading somewhere far away from Mississippi, but I'd speak up." "Wouldn't you be scared?" "You bet I'd be scared. I'd be branded a nigger lover as soon as I showed up in court, and I suppose I'd be lucky if all I got was a few shot-out windows and a burning cross in my front yard." "But you'd do it." "Other than making the decision harder, being scared wouldn't matter one way or the other." He patted the counter. "You stewing about something serious, Hiram?"
"I guess so. It's just that when things are scary or dangerous, it's hard to see clear what to do."
"Well, the best way to work your way through it is to size up both sides of something, then use all the brains you've got to figure out what's right and what's wrong, and make yourself do the right thing. Do that, and no matter what happens, no matter what people say, you'll have no regrets.
That night after dinner, I walked over to the bridge, hoping to see Naomi. Nobody was around when I got there, so I stood at our favorite spot and leaned over the railing to watch the Yazoo flow underneath me. Where the bridge lights reflected off the water, I could see the swirls and sticks, clear signs that the current was moving downstream. But where the shadow of the bridge fell, I saw only black, like the river was pouring into a bottomless pit that swallowed up all the water that came its way. I kicked some pebbles between the railing down into the shadows, but didn't hear or see any sign that they'd broken the water's surface. The old river kept on moving into the blackness under the bridge, taking with it whatever happened to be along for the ride. Being with Naomi would have helped, because I had decided that if she asked me again to promise I wouldn't say anything in court, I'd promise. I'd promise her I'd run away from that subpoena and never go near the Sumner courthouse. Promise her I'd go home to Arizona on the next train. Promise her that I'd be back to see her the following summer and every summer after that. An hour passed. I walked from one end of the bridge to the other. I tossed a few rocks over the side. I counted bars in the railing. I looked for shooting stars. I listed all the reasons why I shouldn't have anything to do with that trial. Naomi never showed up that night, and I was left alone with nothing but my own conscience to help me decide what to do. Right then I wished I was back in Tempe. I wished I had never come to Greenwood, never gotten mixed up with R.C. or Emmett or any of this mess. One of the last things Mom had said to me on the phone was, "Remember who you are, Hiram, and remember to do what's right." Who was I? Hiram Hilburn, a kid from Arizona. Son to an English professor who hated everything about the South. Grandson to a gentleman farmer who loved everything about it. Both men had heads harder than cement, and both charged ahead full speed with whatever they thought was right. What they had in common is what kept them apart. Mr. Paul had told me to use my head, so I started stacking up the positives against the negatives. I knew I could get out of the trial if I really wanted to. Sheriff Smith already had his hands full, and I could slip out of town, and he probably wouldn't bother to do a thing about it. The paper had made it pretty clear that both the defense and the prosecution had already lined up witnesses, and neither one had talked to me yet. So I probably wasn't in either side's game plan. And the sooner I left Greenwood, the sooner I'd be back in school, the less homework I'd have to make up. And I could start smoothing things out with Dad. If I stuck around for the trial, I'd be wasting my time. I'd be in the way. Nothing would get accomplished. Nothing would get changed. The positives outweighed the negatives by a ton. Now all I had to do was go home and call Mom and Dad to tell them I was coming home as soon as I could. Everybody would be glad. Me, Grandpa, Naomi, R.C., and his buddies, Mom, and probably even Dad. So it was settled. I'd run away from the trial. But it wasn't settled. That knot in my stomach didn't go away. It got worse, almost making me want to puke over the bridge rail. All the positives in the world couldn't fool me. I knew what was right, and I knew if I was going to do what was right, I had to show up at the trial and, if asked, tell everything I knew. A boy I knew, had been kidnapped and murdered. And I knew who did it. At least I knew one of the people who had a part in it. Nothing would bring Emmett back to life. But the trial of his killers might be the start of things, might be a small step to making life for Negroes in the South, heck, in the whole United States, a little better. If nothing else, it might make me feel a little better. I was Hiram Hilburn, and I knew what I was going to do. I was going to do what was right. Chapter 14. The Tallahatchie County Courthouse sits smack in the middle of the town square of Sumner, a little town north of Greenwood. And you can tell that when it was built, people figured it had to last till doomsday.
The building is 3 stories of solid brick with long windows on the first and second floors that have solid steel shutters that could be closed in case of atomic bomb blasts, riots, or invasion. Shops and a handful of cafes surround the courthouse. The rest of Sumner isn't much more than a few streets lined with the small houses of townspeople and retired farmers. Early Monday morning, Grandpa and I drove up to Sumner. We were both bleary-eyed and quiet, because we'd been up late Sunday night arguing about whether or not I should tell everything if I got called on to testify. Around midnight, when Grandpa finally realized I wasn't going to change my mind, he swore softly and said, "You're getting to be more like your daddy every day." "And like you," I said. "I'm like Dad and like you. Stubbornness runs deep in Hill Burns." Grandpa shook his head without smiling. "Well then, Hiram Hillburn, we better be getting ourselves to bed. You may be going to that trial, but you're not going alone, and if we don't leave early, we'll end up parking in Webb and hiking the last 2 miles to Sumner." "You sure you want to do this, son?" he asked before I went upstairs. "As far as I'm concerned, I've got no choice," I said. The morning air felt hot and heavy, more like August than September, and low, thick clouds dotted the delta sky. Outside of Greenwood, the sun cast patches of light and shadow across the cotton fields, revealing a thin gray mist unstirred by morning breezes that clung to the tops of the cotton plants. For most of the way up Highway 49 into Tallahatchie County, Grandpa sat like a man going to his own funeral. I couldn't tell if he was tired or mad. I didn't feel like talking to him, so I just concentrated on keeping the old pickup headed north. The highway started filling up with traffic before we even got to Webb, and by the time we made it to the little cotton gin town outside of Sumner, we were backed up behind a long line of cars headed for the trial.
"Knew there'd be a herd of people coming to this," Grandpa muttered.
As we got closer to Sumner, Grandpa got more and more uncomfortable. He kept shifting in his seat, rolling his window up, then down again, turning around to look at the cars behind us. At one point, he blew air out of his mouth and said,
"You know, Hiram, neither one of us got any business being here. We could be sitting in the comfort of our home enjoying Ruth Ann's fine breakfast. Instead, we're up here in this mob."
When we finally reached the edge of town, the streets around the courthouse were so crowded that the local sheriff had blocked off the town square and was directing cars to the side streets beyond the square. Grandpa, swearing and slapping his hand on the dashboard every time traffic got too tight, directed me to a back street a couple blocks from the square. We parked across a bayou east of the courthouse and walked over the bayou bridge and into the crowd waiting for the trial to begin. From the sound of their voices, I could tell most of them were local people. But on one corner of the square, an NBC TV camera had been set up. Scattered through the crowd, reporters and photographers were talking to people and snapping flash photographs. Everyone near us was white. But closer to the front of the courthouse, a large group of Negroes gathered in the street, kitty-corner from the entrance. And even though the streets around the town square were packed with people standing shoulder to shoulder, a clear space separated the Negroes from everyone else. Around 8 o'clock, a heavy policeman came out of the main doors and stood on the steps looking over the crowd. When he spotted the Negroes, he lifted a bullhorn to his mouth and started talking in their direction.
"Listen here, listen here. Let me have y'all's attention."
The crowd quieted down.
"I'm H.C. Strider, sheriff of Tallahatchie County, and I'm under the direction of Judge Curtis L. Swango to make sure things stay orderly. Y'all been waiting a while, and y'all gonna be waiting a little more yet. We can't sit but about 300 people in the courtroom, so the judge wants family and subpoenaed witnesses to enter first. Then the press, if you've got proper credentials. After that, it's first come, first serve. Coloreds come last, of course. We got 3 benches for them set up in back.
He looked at the group of Negroes, and his eyes narrowed.
"Don't want no trouble here. Won't tolerate none."
Then to the main crowd he said,
"All right, folks, we'll be opening the doors shortly,"
and stepped back inside, closing the doors behind him. The crowd swelled forward moments later when two deputies opened the doors.
"Y'all hold on now," shouted one. "Family and subpoenaed witnesses first. Step on back and let them get up here."
People grumbled but let us through. Two women with some young children went in first, then some white men, each holding up his subpoena for the deputy. One of the deputies checked my subpoena and let me and Grandpa in. Five or six Negroes came in after us, heads down, trying to look invisible. When we were all inside, a deputy led us upstairs to the courtroom and searched everyone before we could go in. The deputy told me and Grandpa to sit up front on the right side of the room. It'd be a good place to see everything, and they'd know where to find me if they wanted me to testify. Trial hadn't even started, but the room felt like an oven, and as people came in behind us, they started fanning themselves right away. By 9 a.m., the courtroom was packed. All the regular seats were taken, so deputies brought in more chairs to line the aisles and the walls. Three wooden benches were pushed up near the back, and when the room looked packed enough to explode, a deputy led a group of Negroes in and directed them to sit there. The benches filled up fast, and those who didn't get a seat had to stand outside in the hallway. When it looked like everyone who was going to get a seat had one, there was a commotion outside the courtroom door. Somebody said,
"I'm Charles C. Diggs, elected congressman from the state of Michigan, and I insist on being given a seat in the courtroom."
He argued with somebody for a moment, and then a deputy stuck his head in the doorway and called to an officer inside the courtroom.
"There's a nigger here who says he's a congressman."
"A nigger congressman? That's what this nigger said."
The deputy laughed.
"Hell, that ain't even legal."
A Negro man in a dark suit appeared in the doorway and flashed something from his wallet to one of the deputies, who looked at it a moment, shook his head, and pointed to the benches inside the door.
"Sit over there with the other niggers, and don't give us no more trouble."
I'd expected the courtroom to be quiet and serious like a church, but the crowd buzzed like they were waiting for a carnival to start. A few people smoked cigarettes, and some, only the white people, sipped ice water the deputies had brought in. The Negroes talked quietly among themselves. Grandpa guessed about 300 people were sitting there waiting for the trial to begin. I counted only 35 Negroes, and most of them looked like they'd rather be anywhere but sitting in a hostile courtroom. The first day of the trial wasn't a trial at all. We just sat and watched the district attorney, Gerald Chatham, and his assistant argue with the defense lawyers over who'd be on the jury. The main lawyer for Bryant and Milam was J.J. Breland, an attorney from Sumner who Grandpa knew from some previous dealings.
"Good man," Grandpa said. "Knows the law inside and out, and he's a Southerner born and bred."
He had a whole army of assistants. Mr. Carlton, Mr. Kellum, and a few more that Grandpa didn't know. Mr. Chatham started the questioning by announcing to everyone,
"This case has received wide publicity. The state is going to take every precaution to see that we have a fair and impartial jury."
Most everybody nodded, but I heard some people whisper and chuckle, and when they did, Judge Swango was on them like a rattlesnake. He banged his gavel on his desk and said plenty loud,
"We'll have none of that here. Not today, not until this trial's over. You people who can't be respectful of the law might just as well leave now, because if I hear any more nonsense, I'll have the bailiff throw you out."
The room got quiet right away, and Mr. Chatham waited before talking. He looked at the judge and then at the men waiting to be interviewed and said,
"I'm not going to give the prospective jurors a chance to disqualify themselves because they don't believe in a death sentence."
And as soon as he said it, almost everyone in the room started talking while Judge Swango banged his gavel again. It took a minute or two, but as soon as it was quiet again, Mr. Chatham cleared his voice and said,
"The state will not seek the death penalty in this case."
Grandpa didn't look surprised at all, but I couldn't believe it. No death penalty for kidnapping and murder,
What kind of trial was this going to be?
Then the interviews began. As a prospective juror stood to be questioned, Mr. Chatham asked the same things over and over.
Would you be prejudiced because of race? Did you contribute to the fund for the defense, or would you contribute if you were asked to?
Mr. Breland had his own set of questions for each man.
There's been a whole lot of publicity about the alleged events regarding this Emmett Till boy.
Will you let that in any way influence you?
If the man said no, Mr. Breland then asked,
If you decide to convict, will you be sure beyond a reasonable doubt that the dead body found in the river was the body of Emmett Lewis Till?
The whole time the questioning was going on, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam sat at a wooden table in front of the courtroom. Milam, a big man who was mostly bald, looked about 10 years older than Bryant. They each had one of their little sons on their laps, and when one of the boys got fussy, they'd hand him over their shoulder to their wives, who sat in the row of chairs just behind them. Watching them sit there playing with their Cokes, reading the paper, smoking, or drinking a Coke, I never would have guessed they were on trial for murder. Once in a while they'd talk to each other or point out something in the newspaper they had spread on the table in front of them. But neither one ever said anything to their lawyers or paid any attention to what was going on. After a couple hours of watching both sides interview white men for the jury, Grandpa leaned over and nudged me.
J.J. really knows how to work the law, doesn't he? That old Chatham doesn't have a chance, not one chance in hell.
You think he's ever going to interview any women?
Women can't be on juries in Mississippi, Grandpa said.
What about Negroes?
You've got to be a registered voter to be called into a jury pool. The Negroes don't like to vote in the Delta, so none of them ever bother to register.
Why don't they want to vote? Grandpa answered without looking at me.
That's just the way things are down here.
During the noon recess, Grandpa bought me lunch at a crowded cafe across the street from the courthouse. Neither one of us had eaten breakfast, so we inhaled the chicken salad sandwiches and potato chips Grandpa ordered. After we each had a piece of pie, Grandpa leaned back and sighed.
I can't help but feeling like we're wasting our time up here, Hiram. Chatham's not cooperating at all. If he'd just go along with J.J. Breland, they'd have had that jury picked and seated before lunch.
He looked at me carefully.
You still sure you want to stick around for all this?
I wondered that myself. At the rate the morning had gone, this trial might last for weeks, and I wasn't sure how long I wanted to sit there sweating about being called up to testify. But when I thought about what had happened to Emmett Till, that old Hilburn stubbornness kicked in. I'm staying till the trial's over, but you don't have to come back, Grandpa. There's no good reason for you to be here. He pulled out his wallet to pay for lunch.
I got my reasons, he said.
And under his breath he muttered,
Too many damn reasons for my own good.
Grandpa's reaction surprised me. I had thought that all his fuss about me being at the trial was because he was worried about me. But now I wasn't sure why he didn't want me mixed up in the trial. On the way out of the cafe, Grandpa stuffed a few dollar bills into a fruit jar labeled, Bryant and Milam Defense Fund, Contributions Welcome, on a table by the door. The jar overflowed with money. When settled into our courtroom seats Tuesday morning, we figured to see the jury selection get finished and the trial begin. We hadn't been sitting very long when there was some talking and moving out in the hallway. A moment later, a well-dressed Negro woman about Mom's age came in, and the Negro congressman and another man led her to the benches in the back. When the Negroes sitting there saw her, they all stood up, and a few women hugged her and some others started crying.
The nigger boy's mama, someone said, come down from Chicago.
It didn't take long for the word to spread around the courtroom, and pretty soon white people were turning around in their seats staring at her, mean, hateful stares. A minute later, Sheriff Strider pushed through the crowd,
walked back to the Negro benches and handed her an envelope.
"You've been served," he said without looking at her. "Don't leave the area without notifying the court."
She only nodded and sat down. Tuesday morning dragged like Monday had, but finally, after the lawyers had interviewed more than 100 white men, Judge Swango ordered the 12 jurors and one alternate to sit in a group of chairs on his right and gave them instructions, stuff we'd all heard several times from the lawyers. When he finished, he announced that the trial would be postponed until Wednesday morning because the prosecution and the defense wanted to interview surprise witnesses the prosecution had just subpoenaed. Then he wrapped his gavel on his desk and left the courtroom. A few people applauded, and everybody except me started talking all excited about what had happened so far and what would be next. I didn't want to think about it, but I knew everything would start tomorrow. After supper that night, I wanted to go out and see if Naomi might be waiting by the bridge, but Grandpa wouldn't let me.
"There's trouble brewing, son. This trial's got people riled up, and no telling what some hothead might do, especially if he knows you're on the potential witness list."
I knew he was talking about R.C., but I didn't say anything.
"Best thing for you to do is stay inside, listen to the radio, or read a while, and then get to bed. Tomorrow will be a long day, and even though the paper says both sides want a fast trial, we might be wrapped up in this a lot longer than either one of us wants to be."
"You think I'll have to testify?" Grandpa shrugged.
"You're on their list. Are you still willing?"
"I never wanted to, but I will if I have to."
"You're letting a bunch of knucklehead lawyers decide what's going to happen to you, Hiram."
Grandpa's voice shook and his face turned red.
"A man's got to take charge of his own life. He's got to do what he thinks is right."
I didn't remind him, but that's exactly what I was doing. Wednesday morning, the courtroom was noisier, hotter, and more crowded than ever. The judge reminded us all to behave ourselves and chewed out a couple of photographers for taking pictures in the courtroom.